The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Really, if you think about it, what is more crazy than thinking that a 9.5-year rally is still healthy with vast upside from here? What use are valuations and fundamentals? Ultimately, I think these valuations do matter. When precisely, I don't know. But when they emerge as particularly relevant, we're all going to live with regret that we didn't pay more attention to them.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, I saw your wife at church on Sunday with your youngest of four, but I didn't see you, Dave. I heard that you were up hiking with the eldest kids. Why weren't you at church?
I'm being ratted out on the program. Well, you know, we were capturing sort of the last of the nice weather, beautiful hike. Spent the day before in the car, locked up, driving from Denver there and back in the same day. And
yeah, so, because you have a new addition to the family.
That's right.
You?
We went and picked up a dog that was imported. And so pretty excited about that, but needed to stretch my legs a little bit and spend some time outdoors.
So, well, and you know, when you look at the colors here in Durango right now, I mean, the trees are all changing, the beautiful yellow leaves on the aspens and the other types of trees. And yet you have the snow-capped mountains, the La Platas in the background. And so, of course, no wonder you took a hike.
Well, it's better than stained glass, I think.
You know, last week we talked about the tactical short call with Doug Noland. And those are always fascinating to listen to. And for the person who wants to still listen to that, you can go to mwealthm.com and listen to that tactical short call. But it was very revealing.
Yeah, the audio and the transcripts are available at the website, or you can take the links on this page. And if you're interested in understanding the financial system fragility as it's presently revealing itself, I think taking the time to listen in, or if you prefer, you can read it. You know, simply put, Doug's a talented guy with some very important insights. And the first 30 minutes is formal comments, with the remainder being Q&A. So if your time is limited, catch that first section for sure. But yeah, you know, last week was fascinating for many reasons. We had our call, but it was right in the context of lots of market gyrations. Early in the week, we had expiration manipulation.
Explain what that is, because that's something that actually brings a predictable outcome, at least for the day.
Yeah, so when options are coming to their date of expiration, you're either in the money or out of the money on those options. And you can see pretty predictably in the days leading up to the date of expiration, manipulation in the underlying indexes to get those one direction or the other, further into the money or further out of the money. And so a lot of destruction of value there last week. So again, manipulation was a big deal. We had early in the week the best day in the market since April. Dow was up more than 400 points.
And that was that manipulation that you're talking about.
Right. Now, the news media doesn't talk about manipulation. They pointed to Johnson & Johnson's earnings, which only beat by 2 cents. Not exactly the kind of thing that would set the market on fire. But they also had Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, United Health. And again, I mean, none of them had robust enough results to really set the market in motion. It was primarily expiration manipulation. And Doug covered a little bit of that on the call. You know, where if you have the firepower to do it, you can destroy a lot of value for those put buyers.
Well, you just call your buddies. The other thing too, a lot of people, you know, when you're out there and you're manipulating markets, you do sometimes have to call in your markers with buddies and say, hey, I'm going to be buying this today. How about you buy the same thing? But there's another issue, and there are numbers on charts that everybody looks at, you know, the moving averages. And oftentimes, it's important to push a number above or below a particular moving average to get it to go the direction you're trying to manipulate it.
Yeah, there's different schools of thought as to what a chart means and how you should interpret it. But boosting the markets above the 200-day moving average has been a key here in the last week or so. And a breakdown in technical support levels will trigger automatic liquidations and kind of a reinforcement of risk off, because what happens is option writers have to then hedge themselves and the markets become sort of self-reinforced on the downside. So you try to get protection, but in the process of protecting your own portfolio, you create more pressure, downward pressure in the market. So you've got that battle for the 200-day moving average. It's not over. It's getting dicey. And I think few investors appreciate just how precarious the markets are becoming. Some would interpret that 200-day moving average as a delineation line between a bull and a bear market. Yeah, you know, again, different interpretations, but that certainly is one of them.
Well, if I had to look back at last week, I'd have to say, Mamma Mia, that's a lot of turmoil in Italy. Now, you know, I mean, it really is continuing to break down over across the ocean here.
And I guess the defining characteristic, whether it's the Dow or the options markets, or as you talk about Italy, is volatility. We had wild volatility in bonds and in bank shares. And in midweek, it was Italy that was in turmoil. You've got budget discussions. And the Italians refusing to change their budget deficit, which they've proposed to the EU, and the EU has said, no, we won't accept it. And so there's back and forth with that. Wild volatility in Italy. Moody's cut them to the lowest investment grade. That was, again, just last week. So market concerns by the end of the week had sort of come off the boil. And again, the noteworthy characteristic, if you will, is these radical intraday swings in asset classes. I think it's further evidence of a market topping pattern where the bulls are fighting hard and the bears have a growing amount of evidence to support downside vulnerability.
But the bulls fight it.
Yeah.
The bulls fight it.
Even look at Tuesday of this week. It's a case in point. I'm not exactly sure why? But I told my kids, you know, the Dow traded down 500 points. Gold was up $15 at one point during the day on Tuesday. And my kids interrupted me and they're like, Dad, can you play Rage Against the Machine, Bulls on Parade? And I kind of stopped for a minute. And I'm like, what have I done to
my
kids?
Gosh, they're a bunch of little Doug Nolans. They make their money on the downside.
Right. Is this schadenfreude at such a young age? God forgive me. What have I done?
Okay. But let's face it. We're not looking for the end of the world, but we would like a return to fundamentals.
Right. I think my opening comments on the call centered on that, on just a few of the fundamental metrics, which we've discussed occasionally on the commentary. These are not tradable data points in the sense that valuations don't provide the triggers you'd base a buy or a sell on with sort of an expectation of short-term benefit.
But they are the context. They're the map.
I totally agree. The fundamental valuations provide that context, and they allow an insight into where you are in a particular cycle and how the present moment, in the present position with a particular asset and price structure compares with the past in terms of markets oscillating between very cheap on the one hand to very expensive on the other. And that has a huge bearing where you're at, whether you've bought cheap or bought expensive. It has a huge bearing on future returns on investment. So where you start dictates what you have over a specific period of time in terms of rate of return.
Well, look at people who bought real estate back in 2006. Okay. They may still be working at breaking even versus like our client who came out of real estate in 2006 based on the recommendation of your dad. He went back in 2009, 2010. And you know, he's at triple where he started.
Well, not just in terms of gains, but in terms of actual doors. He tripled the number of doors that he owns.
Right.
So the square feet that he can do. And that's the thing. I think when you look at these cycles, there is a time to be engaged and a time to step back and maybe be more protective.
So buy and hold does not always work. It's buy at a particular time and hold.
Yeah. And so if you're holding, it's with support of that backdrop and with the context being supportive. So, yeah, I mean, if you bought a bargain, your returns are far more likely to be above average. But again, anytime you overpay for an asset, you can take whatever the historical average has been for that particular asset, throw it out. Mm-hmm. Throw it out. It doesn't matter. If you've overpaid on the front end, your returns as an investor are going to be below average. And, you know, vice versa. The other side of the equation applies too. So the average in any investment, the average is rarely relevant because it's not the way markets work. There is a constant volatility in price. And, you know, if you look at the numbers, we talk on the tactical short side of our team about capturing the 40%. Well, just over 50% of the time, nearly 60, prices are moving higher.
Mm-hmm.
Just under 50, we call it 40, prices are moving lower. So, you know, we want to be able to capture some benefit on the downside, but bearing in mind that where you enter in a given cycle, if you've entered at the wrong time, you can be sitting there for a very, very long time with no benefit whatsoever.
You know, and this is one of the arguments that I have against financial planning computer programs that sit the person down. They say, okay, what do you think your bills will be when you're retired? And then they show them on the screen the average return, let's say, for a stock market, which, what has that been? 5, 6, 7% through the years?
Yeah, Jeremy Siegel likes to argue for a number that's just above 7% in his book, Stocks for the Long Run. He makes the claim that a 7% rate of return in equities is the average over time.
But that's meaningless if you buy high.
Well, next week's guest makes the case that markets are far more volatile than the average, where you have returns that occasionally are well above the average number or even considerably below. Mm-hmm. Ed Easterling is from Crestmont Research. That's his organization. He looks at the primary driver of secular stock market cycles, and I think he makes a very compelling case that you have to know where you are before you can know where you are going,
yes.
If that makes any sense. So if you pay attention to the macro picture and the drivers of these long-term trends, then again, like Doug Nolan described in last week's call, it's easier to know when to hold them, when to fold them, when to walk away, when to run.
And one of the things I liked about Ed, you know, selfishly, you know, I like celestial navigation, whether it's on sailboats or just studying the Apollo program, you know, this new movie out, First Man, they're going to be talking about how we got to the moon. And there was a sextant, Dave, both on the lunar module and the command module, where the astronauts would sight known stars and then program that into their very rudimentary, you know, 1960s computer, and it would tell them where they are. And unless they knew where they are, there's no possible way to set the course for where they were going. They would not have made it to the moon had they not have known where they were on the way to the moon. Now, Ed talks about celestial navigation and sort of the progress of that in his book as he looks at the map of financial survival. And he even builds a map. It's an amazing map, Dave, that you could sit and study over and over and over, that has price earnings ratios, what have you, on it, that shows you inflation in the picture, GDP. You can look at the map and go, okay, where are we in the cycle? And what should I buy right now for the long haul?
It's fairly complex, but it's very worth the time investment to understand that matrix, the stock market matrix that he's designed. There's a problem with cycles, as I see it, even though he does a very good job of explaining it, and it's a practical issue. Mm-hmm. The problem with cycles is that most people don't take the time, don't have the patience to benefit from them.
Right.
And
sometimes you just need the money to do something.
Well, that's it. I mean, to be generous, it's too easy. It's quite normal to have things arise where you need liquidity, mm-hmm, in a time frame that doesn't match the moves of the market. So maybe it's buying a house or paying for a car, college tuition, or a wedding, or putting on a new roof.
That sounds like my life, Dave.
the list is long, but things that sort of interrupt the ideal course for the cyclical movement of investments through various asset classes and time. The way he looks at, this is Ed, looks at long-term trends. I remember the first time I read his book, I wrote this back in 2004, long-term trends. I said, well, what does he mean by that? Because everybody's got a different definition of long-term.
Right.
You know, if you're in a tremendous amount of pain, long-term is about 10 seconds. So you know, what is long-term? 50 to 75 years is long-term, with intermediate trends spanning anywhere from 4 to 20 years. And 20 years is a generation. 20 years is a generation. And typically, that's what people would view if you're talking to the average investor. 20 years is long-term.
One of the ways that you've taught people to realign their thinking, I've watched you, Dave, you and your dad, but especially you, since you've written the book Legacy, you've taught people to realign their thinking to these longer term trends and start thinking about their kids and their grandkids, not just today.
Well, yeah, our emphasis on legacy and intergenerational family wealth, it ties to what can be accomplished when you're compounding through many generations versus only one.
It's astounding, the difference.
So the math of compounding over a very long time, that speaks for itself. You could equally talk about the compounding of intangibles, and maybe that's too much of a bunny trail today, mm-hmm, but the compounding of generosity and of trustworthiness and of solidarity, and these things, as they're mirrored and modeled by one generation to the next, you realize that your children, as they grow and mature, have so much more potential growing, maturing in those areas is at an earlier age than you might have. And what they can then pass along in terms of intangible wealth to the next generation is equally profound. So yeah, you've got the math of compounding, which I do think speaks for itself, but time is not a sufficient condition for satisfactory returns. Particular asset classes behave in particular ways under particular circumstances. This goes back to that idea of context, and context matters. So when are you beginning the process? Jeremy Siegel, very unfairly, I think, if you look at where he starts at the very beginning of a bull market to start counting his time forward.
Right.
And so he skews all of his numbers.
That changes his average and skews the numbers.
Exactly, exactly. So stocks for the long run is a brilliant idea, particularly if you start at just the right time.
11 years ago, just about 11 years ago, we started talking on this program, even though the company had been around since 1972. This became a format for us to really evaluate context, Dave. I've been amazed at how much I've learned. It's been like four college educations since we've started because of the people that we've interviewed.
We've discussed context from a sociocultural perspective with Strauss and Howe, using their book, The Fourth Turning, as a tool. Funny you mentioned that. So we talked with Joseph Tainter to explore historical and social, even archaeological shifts through the millennia. And, you know, what he does is he's reflecting on particular data points in his work, The Collapse of Complex Societies.
Well, and even technical analysis. Just a couple of weeks ago, the guys from Bob Prechter.
That's a different way of looking at market trends and cycles. You're right, bringing in Bob Prechter's team, looking at technical analysis, looking for different signs and signals that precede a shift in a market trend.
Right, and Easterling that's coming up, he's going to bring the fundamental side.
Yeah, and I mean, Jeremy Siegel, we've mentioned before in the program, and it's not with utter disrespect. He's a smart man. It's just interesting some of the assumptions that he makes in the midst of saying that stocks are kind of axiomatic a winner, because they can be a winner, but there are caveats for that to be a more accurate appraisal. You have to think of demography and productivity. You have to think of inflation. You have to think of GDP growth and what is happening in a particular period of time as a catalyst for economic growth, with inflation being pretty critical in that equation too. And then, of course, the starting point for your calculations, all of that makes either a case for stocks as a growth asset. Perhaps it's axiomatic, but I tend to think there's a big part in there where it depends. It depends on inflation. It depends on productivity. It depends. It can be a winner if you're sensitive to the drivers of growth. And these drivers or key elements of growth, of course, run in cycles.
It amazes me how many times I can talk to a person who's got an investment portfolio who can tell me where the stock market is relative to dollars. They can say, oh, well, it's at 26,000 right now. Yet if you ask them what the price to earnings, the PE is, oftentimes most people don't even really realize where that is. And that's probably one of the key indicators as to whether you're overpaying or underpaying for the stock market.
I love the way the goalposts are often moved by the mainstream media. When valuations start to get rich, they move from talking about reported earnings to expected earnings. Mm. So now it's not what we brought in, it's what we hope to bring in or have some belief that we'll bring in the future, which all of a sudden can bring down the PE considerably. Now it's earnings which haven't yet occurred on sales which haven't yet been booked on a time frame which has yet to exist, right? But that's okay for the mainstream media to be reporting those future-oriented earnings.
In a way, it's like marking to the imaginary, like we talked about last week.
Yeah, the valuations serve as a signal for where you're at in a cycle. And you're right, some people ask, why does PE matter? Why do, you know, price to sales ratios matter? Why does the Buffett indicator matter? That is, you know, market cap divided by GDP. Why does Tobin's Q matter, or the Shiller PE, you know, kind of an expanded version of PE? And the Crestmont folks actually take the Shiller PE and expand on it. I think they add an extra 10 years for smoothing out to a 20-year time frame. And we'll get a chance to visit with him as to what his rationale for the Crestmont PE is. It's a variation on that same longer-term theme.
Okay, but there's a why you didn't ask. And I'm going to ask you this because every listener who's been paying attention over the last 8 years would say, why should we care about such things? We're in an area that's influenced by central bank control. Why? Why should we care about PE, Tobin's Q, Shiller, you know, Easterling's, Crestmont Research? fundamentals don't matter anymore. We can print money and just paper over things. Why should we care?
Yeah. So that, I mean, that combined with the fact that valuations don't give you anything actionable. So it's not like you can go out and say, on that basis, I'm going to buy this or sell that. Should we care about such things in an era which is so greatly influenced by central bank interventionism? You know, this is not the first time we've had central bank interventionism. It's just the first time we've used these euphemisms. You know, we've had monetization before. We just never called it QE. I don't know that we've done hardly anything new. We've just called it different, and we've done it on a bigger scale.
We had artificial interest rates back in World War II.
Yeah, so yeah. There's controlling elements. We may have refined the processes of control. That's a legitimate question. Has the role of the market, has normal pricing dynamics, has that weakened in the last 8 to 10 years irreparably in favor of a more directed outcome? That's a good question for someone who does secular stock market cycle analysis because, well, I mean, this time may be different. Mm-hmm. What would be the variable that's changed? Maybe it's technological sophistication or algorithms or black box trading that allows for managed outcomes and increased, you know, if you think about the market today, it's kind of unidirectional result in the market. Although, you know, I mean, think about this over in China. This is from the Financial Times last week. A wave of protest by Chinese homeowners against falling property prices in several cities has raised fears of a downturn in the country's real estate market. Can you imagine? This is an epiphany to them that prices can go two directions. They're taking to the streets in protest because real estate prices are dropping. Oh, is that the nature of a market? Again, when you think about command and control dynamics and you think about what the Fed can and can't do, who has more control, the Fed or the PBOC? Where there is no voting machine and you really can lock down, you already have exchange controls in place, capital right. controls in place. The market is moving lower. I don't know if you've checked the Shanghai Exchange. Yeah. Shanghai Exchange is down 30% this year.
Yeah.
The powers that be, you don't think they could prop that up if they wanted to? That's the point. They may want to, but they are not able to ultimately control the direction of the market.
Okay.
For a short period of time, sure.
This is where being around for a long, long time starts to really help. Are these the types of questions that are always asked before the secular cycle changes? And I'll go back to 1987. I brought this up because the first year that I started working here, I got Fortune magazine in the summer and it said, our stock's too high. New methods of valuation say that we're not going to have a crash. Well, we had the largest crash since 1929 that October. Okay. In 1999, I got Wired magazine, you know, the technological magazine Wired, and it was doing the same thing with tech stocks. It said, are stocks too high? Could these possibly ever crash? And they said, no. If you look at the potential of the internet and the potential of the dot-coms, there's no way that this thing will crash. And of course, we saw almost the complete evaporation of the NASDAQ, you know, within months of that article. So is this same question being asked with the central bank in this case saying, you know, why should we care about fundamentals? We now have a new technology that can manage these things.
Yeah, well, markets and fundamentals are interesting. I mean, you know, if you think about the life and trajectory of RCA.
The dog listening to the big, you know, phonograph.
That's right. So you go back to the 1920s and 30s, you begin to see market penetration.
It was radio, wasn't it? Radio?
It's radio.
Yeah.
And first there's 100,000 homes that have radios in their home, and then there's 500,000 homes the very next year. And you see this growth in trend. And, you know, they weren't defunct until 1986 when GE bought them. But there is a long period of time where not only do they get crushed in the Great Depression, but then they also had to go through that period of price controls where the government was in charge of capital and the pricing of capital in the interest rate market all through the 1940s. So technology has a great story. There's no doubt, you know, betting on the tomorrow, whatever the tomorrow may have, whether that's AI or cloud computing, there's no question that these are technologies in their infancy, but that does not change the market.
Well, and you want to bet when the price is low. That's your whole point in this program. You want to bet when the price is low, not after the rise.
But I agree with you. There are points in a secular cycle where a generation has come to make certain assumptions about the price of money, about the average annual returns of particular asset classes. And it is the kind of thing, the kind of questions that you begin to hear, I think they're fairly common at the end of a cycle, and it's based on all that you know to be true, all of your experience in a generation as an investor. Mm-hmm. You think, how old do you have to be an investor that remembers interest rates above 7, 8, 9, 10%? You're talking about not one generation of investors, but two generations ago. If you're counting a generation in 20 years, you're talking about nearly two generations ago, where someone appreciates that you can have interest rates above 10% instead of here near the zero bound.
One of the things I think we take for granted, Dave, is the written word. We live in an area where we had ancient Native American cultures here down in southwest Colorado, Utah, northern New Mexico, Arizona. And spending time in those places, you can tell these were not dumb people. They understood what they were doing. They a lot of times built buildings in alignment with moon cycles or solar cycles. They didn't write things down, however. And so the only thing they could really capture are small generational types of things. Everything was really living for the day. One of the things I'm looking forward to with Ed Easterling coming on is his market matrix, this map that we were talking about. Because you can look at that and say, okay, let's go back to the year 1900. What do we want to know? What was price earnings ratio in 1929? What if we were to have bought a stock in 26 and sold it in 1934? You can really ask of that map, that matrix, almost any question and get answers that even Easterling may not know because the map itself tells the story.
Right. So, you know, we talked about the problem of having these assumptions, which are informed by, you know, what has become status quo, performance of a particular asset class, directional trend, and things like that. History is larger. History is longer than a generation, even multiple generations.
And it allows you to live many lives if you just go back and read it.
Yeah. Trends don't, as it turns out, they don't bend to the whim or fancy of our expectations, our desires, our time frame to retirement, our immediate needs. These things are happening, and you either observe them, take advantage of them, or don't observe them and be abused by them. Those are kind of the options in the asset market. So, you know, it was months ago on the weekly commentary, I made the observation, this was an observation borrowed from this matrix you're talking about, page 28 and 29 of Ed Easterling's book, Unexpected Returns. That's where you find the stock market matrix.
It's worth the price of the book.
It's brilliant. It takes a few minutes to dive into the complexity of those pages. But on that page is a map most invaluable. And again, if you're a student of history, if you're intrigued by finance, I'd suggest the book, if only for those two pages. But if you unpack all that is on those two pages and come to understand the relationships reflected there, the relationships between economic variables, between asset classes, et cetera, your expected returns over one or more cycles are likely to be considerably improved if you imply well.
And the observations and the conclusions can be non-intuitive when you look at the chart. I mean, what conclusion did you come away with that you were mentioning that you borrowed?
Yeah. Well, if you study the matrix, you see that the economy is not the primary driver of positive rates of return in financial assets.
Stop that for a second. The economy is not the primary driver of financial assets. That's so counterintuitive. Most people think, well, gosh, things are going well in the economy. I've got a job. My son's got a job. The stock market's going up.
Right. So I agree. That may sound odd. If you've listened to the commentary, if you're a regular commentary listener, this may sound familiar. The period of 1966 to 1981 was marked by economic growth. And that economic growth in that period of time outstrips even the Chinese run rate of the last decade or more, right? So who has been the largest GDP contributor globally in the last 10 years and still is today? It's the Chinese.
Right.
Well, go back to this 1966 to 1981 period. The U.S. was dominant. A 9.6% average growth rate in the U.S. economy in that time frame.
Wow.
9.6%
GDP,
average.
GDP, 9.6.
And yet it was not accompanied by growth in equities. Not accompanied by growth in equities. To the contrary, one of the best periods of economic growth in U.S. history was awful for equity investors. Awful. right?
And with the flavor that we have right now, we talk to a lot of people who are like, well, Trump is changing the economy. Stock market's got to go up.
That's great. That's wonderful. I'm enthusiastic as a supporter for economic growth, but it doesn't necessarily translate into higher financial asset prices. And that's the point we've been trying to make. You may be enthusiastic about, you know, the Trump bump or whatever you want to call it, the Trump economic miracle. I don't know that it has anything to do with him. Certainly lowering tax rates is helpful in some quarters. But what is the White House after? The White House is after growth in nominal GDP, growth in nominal GDP. They don't care about inflation. That is an agenda item, growth in nominal GDP. But investors are assuming that that means increased profits for corporate America and a booming stock market. Ergo, you should go out and buy stocks before the train leaves the station, and you get sitting there on the stage left out of this next growth phase.
You know, even though the PE right now is above 30.
Again, my point is that economic growth and financial asset prices can behave independently of each other for a considerable amount of time, even for a generation. So look more recently. This occurred from 2009 to 2016. You had anemic economic growth. That's a generous description. Right? Relative to the monetary stimulus put into the system from the world central bank community. Growth in this period, 09 to 16, was the weakest on record for a quote unquote recovery period. Yet equities and bond prices rose in spite of the subpar economic metrics. It was not the economy driving the stock market. The stock market was doing its own thing and the economy was languishing. Now the economy is picking up ahead of steam, and it cannot be assumed that the stock market and the financial markets in general, including fixed income, are necessarily going to be moving higher in that context. So we have increased economic growth. It remains to be seen if equities can maintain that sort of astral trajectory from the post-election 2016 post-election liftoff.
You know, something that Ed Easterling brings up too, and I really can't wait to hear what he has to say on this, but I have to dust off a word that I don't think anybody believes in anymore. It's called inflation. Dust it off. Inflation used to be an issue. Easterling says inflation always is an issue when it comes to determining value in the market, and inflation is coming back.
He makes the case that inflation trends are, A, if they are not the determining factor in valuation metrics and ultimately the direction of prices in the stock market. Hmm. And of course, inflation has a major impact on the bond market as well. So in a period of relative price stability, guess what? As you might expect, in a period of relative price stability, asset prices do exceptionally well. You see growth in stocks, you see growth in bonds. But in periods of either rapidly developing deflation or inflation, either shift away from price stability equals a decline in financial asset values.
Yeah, his chart shows that. It's fascinating. And it doesn't just mean inflation. It's like what you said. Deflation will also do it. To have rising stock prices and continue to have that healthy, you really can't have either inflation or deflation.
This is a very critical point. If you recall last week, we discussed the Fed's shift toward an inflation focus.
Right.
As Bianco did his word search and kind of through an algorithm, looked at how often they're talking about it in concerned language. So as the CPI gradually rises, consumer price index, as velocity gradually increases, which it is ever so gradually, mm-hmm. The question's on the table. Where do asset prices go in the context of rising inflation and rising interest rates? And this is where, again, Jim Bianco argues we're headed towards a renewed investor concern on inflation. Even if we don't have radical inflation itself, we have a renewed investor concern on inflation, which he's convinced brings the correlation of stock and bond performance into alignment. Where do you hide?
Right.
Is how Bianco frames the issue. Where do you hide?
And even though the stock market's come off from its highs that we had, you know, a month ago, it's still only 5 or 6% below its high. So nobody's asking that question right now.
Well, you're right. The investing public is not asking the question, where do you hide? Because we're only a stone's throw away from record levels. So, I mean, Ed argues that as rates and inflation rise, investors demand higher compensation for the risk in the market. So again, follow that through. Interest rates and inflation are on the rise. Investors demand higher compensation for the risk in the market, and asset prices as a result get discounted to open up a future of higher returns.
In other words, you need lower prices and able to gain higher returns later.
Yeah, high does not go from high, higher, highest, and then just kind of infinitely keep on rising.
No, you want to go from low to high.
That's right. Prices have to go down for the possibility of higher than average returns to emerge. And I think that's often lost on investors.
Mm-hmm.
Higher returns are predicated on lower prices. And lower returns into the future are determined by higher prices. And I think, again, investors don't want to do that. They want to go after red hot markets. They want to go after things that are priced expensively because they're performing well in that moment, not looking ahead and saying with some predictive capacity, high prices don't become high, higher, highest. High prices ultimately become low prices, and that's how you end up with subpar returns. Why they won't touch bargains is beyond me. But in both cases, the issue here is that extrapolation leads an investor to make a mistake, that of either buying high or selling low. These are the classic errors of optimism and pessimism.
Weren't you in the Bahamas one time and met Sir John Templeton, and his classic phrase was to buy bargains?
Buy bargains. What set Templeton apart is that he would look for bargains in any part of the world. So being an international investor in a period where international was not common, really gave him a leg up. But what was he doing? Whether it was domestic or international, buying bargains was the ticket. And it's not as easy as it sounds, because it takes a combination of conviction on the one hand and patience on the other, because cycles have to play themselves out. This is not something that happens in a moment, in a day, even in a week, or even in a year. If you want long-term outperformance and growth, conviction and patience are there. Patience implies time. Patience implies time as a resource that you're working with. So, and we talked about this earlier. You've got life events that sometimes mitigate against long-term investment success by shortening time horizons to the point that cycles can't be used to your advantage.
One of the ways that you watch cycles as well is through a friend of yours, Alan Newman, who writes just a great report. We've had him on the program. And actually, these numbers are not on the matrix that we're talking about, but they should be, which is margin debt. I mean, how much are people borrowing to actually buy stocks? And right now, margin debt numbers are at all-time highs.
Well, we've put that in the category of a sentiment indicator. How enthusiastic are investors about owning stocks today? And now that the number is north of 3.2% of GDP.
It's never been that high.
It's grown 3.3 times in this phase of growth in equities. Margin debt has grown by 3.3 times since 2008, 2009, that time frame.
Yeah, and if you could look at the chart, which we can't audibly do with our listeners, you would actually see that every time it gets up into this range or even just near it, we have a major repricing of the stock market.
Well, because you've got an overhang of liquidations. It's not as if these are strong hands. This is borrowed money on borrowed time.
Right. They're forced.
Right.
They're forced out of those stocks when it goes down a certain percentage.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got the threatening there of a catalyst, large forced liquidations in equities with that, you know, $650 billion, 669 was the peak in May, of borrowed money in the equity markets, 3.3 times what it was just a few years ago. Now, factor this in. With rising inflation, with rising interest rates on that margin debt, you have an adjustment yet to take place in the category of investors and their expected returns. And as you see an expectation of high returns, as you see that dimmed or diminished, all of a sudden you see the allocation shifts occur. Mm-hmm. And many of the allocation shifts will be knee-jerk out of stocks into bonds. Unfortunately, in a period of correlation, moving from the frying pan into the fire is not going to be of that much help.
Doug Nolan has pointed out that this time the bubble that we have, which is clearly a bubble, will probably collapse from the periphery in. And the Shanghai Composite you mentioned earlier is down 30%. When does that start to catch up actually to home markets?
Right. Well, I mean, Bloomberg noted the extra pressure in the Chinese markets. Shanghai, you're right, 30% down since January. At its worst, at its worst. I see this week it's picked up a little bit. Officials pledge support and the markets are reversing to the upside, 4% in the day. As the U.S. stock market was selling off 2-3% on Tuesday, you had the Chinese again stepping in to prop up the equivalent of their plunge protection team active in the markets.
Yeah, but how many stocks are actually being purchased? I mean, relative to the declining stocks, I mean, decline versus gains.
Right. And that's, I mean, if you're looking at last week's trend in the Shanghai, 13 times the amount of liquidations to purchases, 13 companies being sold for every one purchased. And I mean, okay, that's fascinating for the overseas markets. Bringing it home here, Bespoke Investments highlighted a similar trend here in the U.S. last week. We had 266 new 52-week lows in the S&P 500, only 16 new 52-week highs. So what is this telling you about deterioration? Weakness is certainly there in China. But here in the U.S., you've got a few big gainers, big name gainers, which are covering over what is broad-based weakness here in the U.S. markets.
So have we created our own problem? I asked you a question midway through the program of, do we really care about fundamentals because of central bank intervention? But even Trump recently has been saying that his greatest threat is the Federal Reserve. They're having to raise rates. The rates are coming up anyway worldwide. So does it still come back to the central bank, and have we created a problem that's going to now play out?
Well, it reminds me of the days of Arthur Burns, where you see pressure from the Oval Office and compliance, very little independence and separation between the executive branch and the Federal Reserve being exhibited under that particular time frame. You listen to Trump in his interview with Trish Regan this last week. Fascinating. I mean, it's worth thinking about the tough spot the Fed is in. This is what he said. This is what Trump said. My biggest threat is the Fed. And he said this in the interview, because the Fed is raising rates too fast and it's too independent.
Is he setting up a straw man also for what he thinks is probably going to happen?
Well, I mean, there's nothing surprising here. He knows that higher rates will derail the economic growth narrative, if nothing else, by taking the enthusiasm out of stocks and bonds, right, and that having sort of a negative feedback loop within the economy. But let that sink in. This is every politician's dream, control of the money supply. It's very tempting. This is like Gollum in the Ring, or if you go back to Gyges in book two of Plato's Republic.
All the way to Plato, yeah.
What would you do if you had total control?
Right.
And that's all he wants is what a president should have, total control of everything, right? Particularly if it's over gold and money and all that stuff. So the Fed is too independent, he says. What would our monetary policy look like today if it was an extension of the executive branch,
right?
We already said earlier, real GDP growth, that's not his objective.
I think we would see Venezuela is what we would see.
Well, that's exactly
with
right.
Any administration.
Because, see, when you prioritize nominal GDP growth and don't pay attention to real GDP growth, which factors in inflation, if you're just looking for a headline number to say, hey, look, I'm the new hero, I'm the new knight on a white horse, I'm the new guy in town, I've done things that no one ever imagined doing, well, so has the president of Venezuela, if you're talking about nominal values. I mean, this is spectacular. We're talking about success in the trillions. Now, it doesn't really matter that much when it comes to buying groceries or a cup of coffee or toilet paper. But, you know, nevertheless, we've got a White House that would focus on nominal growth over real GDP growth. Inflation be damned, he's going to make America great again. And what's fascinating to me is Trump is saying the Fed is going crazy. The Fed's doing what they said they were going to do, gradually raise rates. The challenge is that does have an impact. It is the equivalent of taking away the punch bowl. And no president, no standing president, no standing political party is interested in the punch bowl being taken away, because it will affect the economy. It will affect the financial markets. And there will be, whether it's legitimate or not, there will be a blame game played. There will be fingers pointed and political ramifications.
So he's saying they're going crazy.
I think, really, if you think about it, what is more crazy than thinking that a 9.5-year rally is still healthy with vast upside from here? So again, what use are valuations and fundamentals? Maybe they're just sort of the wallpaper that's in the background and they provide some context, but nobody really cares what's hanging on the wall. Ultimately, I think these valuations do matter. When precisely, I don't know. But when they emerge as particularly relevant, we're all going to live with regret that we didn't pay more attention to them.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.